Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Before starting our interview today, I want to go over a few housekeeping details, including improvements that we've made to our website. First of all, we finally installed a more effective spam filter that will help me manage our discussion forum a bit better. I have been neglecting that forum because it has been inundated with unwanted messages. But now that we have our spam filter up, I urge you to visit our website, www.researchonreligion.org, and post your thoughts about the interviews that you hear. I think we'll be able to talk to a couple of our guests and get them to answer some questions as well. So if you want to follow up with a point that you heard during the interview, please feel free to ask questions. We'll leave that forum open for 3 weeks after each podcast airs. Second, we've improved our social media outreach and now have buttons that you can click for each podcast on our webpage and that will help get out the word about our free educational service via Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or other social networking platforms, including ye olde email. So please do visit our website, and if you like what we're doing, help us spread the word. And then finally, we do have a Facebook page that keeps you updated with what is going on with our podcast and lets you link with other people who share similar interests. You can like this page by going to our website and clicking on the Facebook icon on the right side banner, or do a search on Facebook under Research on Religion with Anthony Gill. As of this recording, we have about 120 fans on our page. Hopefully after this podcast, we can bump that number up to 200 or more. So please do help us spread the word and tell your friends and colleagues about this free educational podcast that we're offering courtesy of Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion. All right, now on to our regular show. One of the main topics that consistently grabs the attention of social scientists studying religion is the question of church growth. Why and how do some denominations expand, whereas others seem to be shrinking in membership and attendance? For the most part, we scholars tend to focus on large macro-sociological trends that affect entire denominations, such as changes in the culture at large or theological controversies that arise in various faith traditions. Rarely do we ever go down to the micro level to examine the leadership and management of individual congregations. But it should come as no surprise that the success of a church often depends on the skills that a pastor or a board of elders brings to that community. Now, this is not to say that there hasn't been anything written about church management. Indeed, Christian bookstores are often filled with how-to guides written by successful ministers, but these books largely go unnoticed by sociologists. Today, I want to explore the issue of church management at the local level by talking with a successful minister and someone who has penned a number of books on pastoral strategy. In particular, I want to focus on the issue of church finances. My interest in this topic was recently sparked by an article I saw on Christianity Today, raising a debate over whether or not pastors should have access to the tithing records of their individual congregants. This piqued my interest because I had always thought that pastors and priests did know this stuff to begin with, but apparently that isn't always the case. And this article also pushed my latent interest in how churches do finance themselves, particularly since the financial health of a church both is a partial indicator of how successful it has been in the past and how well it is likely to do in the future with its missionary call. So to help me make heads and tails of this all, I'm pleased to be joined by Pastor Larry Osborne of the North Coast Church in Vista, California. Like many successful churches, North Coast began as a Bible study group in the mid-1970s and has grown over the past 3 decades to minister to over 8,000 worshipers every Sunday across 3 different campus locations. Larry, who has been the pastor at North Coast since 1980, is also the author of numerous books, including Sticky Church, Sticky Teams, and 10 Dumb Things Smart Christians Believe. That latter book I know is not about me, since there are about 125 dumb things that I believe, and I'm supposed to be a smart Christian, although I think my pastor would tell me that the word smart not be put before that in terms of me. Anyways, Pastor Osborne also maintains a blog called Larry Osborne Live, where he publishes his thoughts on a variety of topics. We're going to link to that blog as well as to all our books on that website and on our website. So please make sure you visit. Larry, welcome to Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. Good to be with you.
I want to come back to the title of one of your books called Sticky Church, because I think most people probably think that's about how churches that meet in movie theaters have to contend with all the spilled soda and gummy bears on the floor. But before I come back to that question about sticky churches, I have to ask a little bit of a question that it signifies some of my ignorance on geography. Now, you're pastor at North Coast Church, but you're located in Southern California. So how do you reconcile those two differences?
Well, we're not only located in Southern California, we're located in San Diego. But bottom line, we're as far north as you can be along the coast and still be in San Diego. Then above us, going north is Camp Pendleton, and then you have Orange County in L.A. And the south part of Orange County, ironically, north of us, is called South Coast.
Yep.
So I figured if they could call themselves South Coast, we could call ourselves North Coast. So locally in Southern California or San Diego, it makes a lot of sense. But around the nation, yeah, a lot of people think we must be up by San Francisco or something.
Yeah, no, I used to live in Costa Mesa by South Coast Plaza, and so in order to get to North Coast Church, I'd have to drive south, which is somewhat confusing.
That's actually where we got the name from, South Coast Plaza.
Oh.
This area originally was called North County, and I just thought, well, it's on the beach. Coast is a better name. We started using that, and ironically, hundreds of businesses now use that same name.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Churches are the leading indicators for a lot of things. So, and I should now give you a chance to go back and tell the audience what your book, Sticky Church, is about, because I do think it relates to some of the things that we're going to be talking about here, which is the successful management of a church. So if you could just give us a brief lowdown about what a sticky church is.
Well, the elevator speech behind it would be that a sticky church is a church that focuses on slamming the back door shut, rather than constantly trying to open the front door wider. And in that book, I talk about the real key being building significant and authentic relationships. We have in our churches a lot of people who know one another, kind of an acquaintance level sort of friendship, if you will, but not the connectedness. In real relationships, when you have somebody, how's it going, they might say fine, kind of the standard church answer, but you know them well enough to go, come on, that's not true. And what we have discovered over the years is that the close, significant, and authentic friendships is the strongest Velcro that you could ever have to people. In fact, time after time, somebody doesn't leave a church that's maybe gone through a couple embezzlements, an affair, whatever, and you say, why didn't you leave? And they always say the same thing, well, my friends are there.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea is to create that so that you can have a truly sticky church, slamming that back door shut. And it's not to grow the church larger. It's not to keep people from moving on into the kingdom, but it's basically so that you have the opportunity to fulfill the Great Commission, which is to make disciples, followers, and then Jesus has a second half, teaching them to obey everything that I taught you. And you just can't do that in a revolving door church. You can get, quote, decisions, but you can't really create disciples who are walking in obedience unless you're connected over the long term.
I can imagine that's a really important task to fulfill, especially in a large church or some of these mega churches that we've been hearing quite about on our podcast, that it would be easy for any individual congregant to be somewhat anonymous in that church. So that's really must be a pastoral challenge to make that larger church feel smaller.
Absolutely. And in my mind, any church over 300 or 400 historically is a very, very large church.
Yeah.
Before the mobility of the automobile, when you were stuck in neighborhoods, it was a different animal. So we talk about mega churches having a problem, but frankly, churches of 400 or 500 are often revolving doors because they haven't found a way to connect people. And instead of counting faces, they just count numbers. And if the numbers are up, it must be a good year, even if, well, let's just say you grew by 200 people and lost 100. That's really not a good thing. But if you're just in the number zone, it'll sound like, wow, we grew by 100 people. Like, no, not really. You you lost 100 people as well.
Yeah. Well, speaking of small churches and large churches, this brings me to the question about your own specific church. Your ministry has obviously been very successful in attracting and keeping membership fairly active. And you've grown from a small handful of folks in this Bible study group in 1975, 76 to this large multi-campus operation. So how did you achieve that?
Well, you know, every situation is completely unique culturally, geographically, the time frame. So there were a lot of things that were probably unique to our situation here in San Diego, besides the things that we did in terms of the way we organized the church and all of that. So you could do the same thing in one place, it explodes positively and it explodes negatively in another. But having said that, a couple of things have been really important. Back about 180, and that would be kids and adults, I had this sense that we were fooling ourselves, that we were a core of worker bees at the center of this church, which maybe had, on typical weekend, let's say 110, 115 adults showing up out of that 180. And we were deeply connected, and we thought we were this church doing that. But in reality, everybody knew was circling around wondering how they could connect, that they just couldn't quite make it into that inner circle. So we made a decision to make the hub of our ministry what we called sermon-based small groups, which is kind of a lecture lab model where we take the text and the topic of the weekend and dig deeper into it. And so we started that at 180, felt God calling us to have 80% of our weekend adult attendance in those. And we've scaled that now for over 26 years, which means in three different decades and the cultural changes, the obvious huge growth to the 8,000 plus we have today. That's really been a major part. People are always surprised. We don't market or advertise at all. Not that I'm theologically against that, but we felt like God probably, if we were taking care of the people we had, would cause them to bring their friends. And if we would slam that back door shut, we'd have more than we could handle. So we've really been, for the 30-plus years that I've been here, a word-of-mouth church that has focused on building significant relationships among the people. Now, obviously, we're very biblical in our approach to life, and we have children's programs and youth programs and all that. But the real hub is these small groups and the relationships.
Mm-hmm. And we've talked quite a bit about that on previous episodes that we've had here, how the small group can make very large churches very effective. They essentially become small churches unto mm-hmm. themselves. And I think that is one of the big successes that you've seen in church growth recently in the last, you know, three or four decades. Have you had any significant challenges that you've had to face and overcome?
Well, certainly. And, you know, I've been here, I think next month will be my 31st anniversary here. So I've all kinds of them, from the more recent financial meltdowns that have been part of our culture. But some of the bigger things is simply adapting to culture over time, because the calendar keeps changing, and I think sometimes as leaders we don't change. We think the sweet spot of doing ministry in terms of its forms is the sweet spot of our youth or our kind of vitality as an organization. So we've had to morph and change. I mean, when I first started, it was an age of conspicuous consumption, and excellence was a key word. Now words like authenticity are key words. When I first came, I preached in suits with monogrammed shirts and everything, all GQ. Now I preach in jeans and a Tommy Bahama shirt and flip-flops. Mm-hmm. You know, the world keeps changing, and not everybody wants to make those adaptations to the culture without changing your core message. And then the second would be the adapting to size has constantly been a challenge. That I put churches in categories. I say, you know, the startup church is like you're like a track star. The small church with a couple of key staff might be like golfing buddies, and then you become like a basketball team and eventually a football team. And that move from golf to basketball to football style relationships and complexity always is a challenge, because a lot of people want to go back to what was instead of move forward to what needs to be.
Yeah, I can imagine that's difficult. It's the same thing with the culture changes as well. I'm sure you get a lot of pushback on some of the changes. I know in our church, we recently hired a pastor who has gone to preaching with his shirt untucked, and that became a big issue, surprisingly, among many of the congregants. And I'm just curious, how do you keep your finger on the pulse of culture? I know as I'm getting older, it's just very difficult to do that. So are there certain things that you're looking for? Do you have people around you that say, hey, you're looking a little bit old and fuddy-duddy? Yeah.
Well, I try to surround our key leadership team with people that are under 40. I came when I was 28 years old to become the senior pastor of this place, and I had dreams and I had vision. I was pretty culturally connected. But what happens is we get older, the freshmen get smaller every single year. And you can be in your 50s and think somebody 35 is too young, you know, to be on your elder board or to be a key decision maker, and yet they're old enough to be president of the United States.
Yeah.
And so one of the things I've worked very hard on over the years is to make sure not to just have a token one or two, but a significant input from that, say, 30 to 35-year-old up to maybe 40 and young, well, basically 40 and younger, at the key meetings that influence how we do things around here. Plus, at the same time, rather than trying to change within, we have always tried to create new things along the fringe or outside. So, for instance, we're a church now. We got large enough to have venues, and in fact, we kind of started that thing back in 1998. Where you have different styles of worship simultaneously. So I can have a tradition service now that has actually included in it is the family that our church started in their home. They opened their home for the Bible study. There is no way they would like where the culture is now in terms of the loudness of the music and certain things, but they've got their tradition service, and they're happy, and I can have an edge service at the other end of the extreme. And we're not telling people that somehow they, you know, if you love Jesus, you have to start liking Mountain Dew and big subwoofers.
Mm-hmm.
It's really okay. We'll be a both and kind of ministry without ever changing our core message, but go ahead and changing the packages of it.
Yeah, that is kind of neat, and it does fit in some ways with the small group philosophy, is that there's different ways people can plug in, and so a larger church size may allow you to have that greater variety, which can attract and, as you say, keep people stuck in the church.
Yes, absolutely. There's this myth out there that unity means blending everything into some homogenous, just whatever, that nobody's happy kind of deal. And I believe the unity body of Christ is shown at its greatest when the diversity is celebrated, not thrown into a blender so that everything has changed. So we've celebrated the diversity in the body of Christ without making everybody kind of change who they are.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things you just mentioned a few minutes ago was the challenge of the recent financial meltdown. And so that brings me to the issue of church finances, which really is interesting to me, because I don't think a lot of folks, either in the social scientific study of religion or even sitting in the pews on a Sunday, know a whole lot about how churches get financed. And as I mentioned in the introduction of our interview, that the financial health of a church really is indicative of a number of things. First, if financial contributions are growing and parishioners are giving a healthy percentage of their income or their first fruits, this is going to indicate that the church leadership is doing a pretty good job in building organizations, because people want to give to places they feel comfortable with, they feel have a good future there. And also, it's going to provide some indication of what the church can do in the future with its missionary outreach programs. So I'm just going to kind of explore this issue about the financial situation at North Coast. And first of all, I just want to ask a simple question of who's in charge of managing your finances, and has that changed over time?
Yeah, it's definitely changed over time. When I first came, it was, we call them elder, some churches deacons or presbyter, you know, all kinds of different names or big shots, but our board, there was a treasurer, and he took care of those things. As we grew larger, we hired staff to handle the accounting. And so there's somewhat of a difference once we hit 400 or 500 again between accounting, which took care of the information, and then management, which decided what to do with it. When our church was quite small, 70, 80 adults, what was happening is basically the treasurer, when he said we could do something, we could do it. If he said no, it didn't matter. Everybody went, well, he must know, because he held the information very close to the vest. Now our management team, which would be staff, and it's been that way for a long time, we would make directional decisions based on the information our accounting department, if you will, would give to us.
Mm-hmm. And so what? Let me ask you what the basic demography of your giving looks like at your church. Do you see a fairly equitable spread, or are there some really big time donors, and then everybody gives small chains? What give us a feel for that?
Well, we're pretty healthy in that sense. We're a middle class church with, you know, some wealth. Any group our size would have power brokers in the community and all that. But we are not a wealthy church. You know, many churches with someone of my age that has been around kind of that mega church with a boomer leader, they were in new growth areas or where there was tend to be a lot of wealth. We frankly don't have that, but we have a very strong across the board support of our ministry financially with people. So I would say our church is middle class with obviously some upper middle class, and then we have people on aid to dependent families in our community.
Mm-hmm. Does the giving vary over time of year? Now it's summertime. We're recording this in early August, and that seems to be somewhat of a downtime for churches. Do you experience
the same
thing? Yeah,
there's a little bit of a blip because some people go on vacation. Now in San Diego, I happen to be where they go on vacation, so we might not have the same blip as you might in, say, the upper north, Midwest, where everybody's heading off to a lake or getting away after, you know, a tough winter or whatever. But what we have is little ups and downs, but not huge. The down in summer is related totally to the little lower attendance, and then of course there's a year-end bump in December because people are figuring out tax things and all of that. So December is always quite large. Large for us.
Here's another question. This is really gets to the basic mechanisms of how this stuff is done, and I think sociologists oftentimes overlook little things like this. But it's something that I've noticed, having gone to different churches throughout my life, having started life as a Catholic, and now in the Protestant church that I'm in, is how you actually collect the tithes. Back in the days when I was a Catholic, they used to pass the plate, and it would come around. And a few months ago, I was at a Presbyterian church; they did the same thing. But our church recently changed its format, and we just put a basket out by our communion table, and people, you know, walk by the communion table and put stuff there. So how do you guys collect the tithes? Do you do this online, or has this changed over time?
Yeah, it's definitely changed over time. We still collect an offering in our situation, but we do it at the end of the service, and our real goal is to get what we call worship response cards from people. And we do it at the end because if you do it in the middle, people feel like they're registering, and no one wants to register. They're afraid they're getting, you know, caught in a timeshare or whatever it would be. But at the end of the service, they'll be responding to the message, prayer requests, things like that. But if you were to look at the baskets that are passed, you'd wonder how this church runs, because all you find in there is cards, very few checks or whatever. And that's pretty much because, no one under, you know, 35 carries a checkbook with them anymore, and they don't carry cash. So it has changed quite radically. When I first started out, people would stop and write a check and drop it in. Now a great deal of our income comes through monthly electronic funds transfers, online giving and stuff like that. So we would fit into the category of churches that more or less have stopped taking an offering, but we still pass that basket because there is some income that comes through that, but mostly it's our source to get information from our congregation out of those worship response cards.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that as being someone who's over 35. And nobody does carry cash or checkbooks anymore. We carry, my wife always has a checkbook, so I never carry a checkbook. But so we're there writing checks. I'm thinking, yeah, some of the younger folks in our congregation probably just have the debit card.
Absolutely.
And I doubt they could toss that into the basket and say, hey, run this through the magnetic strip and send it back to me, or they'll punch in my PIN code.
Yeah, I've been, if I'm speaking at a group trying to show this, I will sometimes ask pastors, okay, everybody under 40 stand. And then how many of you have more than $20 in your wallet? And sometimes it'll be nobody. I say to the guys, notice this. You're operating on a rather old paradigm. When you think you're going to survive on passing the plate.
This reminds me of something, too. And the fact of passing the plate, it's a very public event. And people see this. People see each other putting cards in. And you know, I'm very conscious of this when I put in cash in our tithing bucket. And there was this article in the Journal of Political Economy back in 1994, I'm reminded, by Kelly Olds, who talked about how they did tithing back in the colonial America, that they would go around from household to household. And they actually had a petition. It wasn't a petition, but it looked like a petition sheet. And they would go to the wealthiest household first, have the person write down their name, and then write their contribution, and then take that piece of paper to the next house. And that was fascinating because it created a little bit of social pressure for everybody there to look at everybody else's contribution and to try to meet that 10% tithing goal that we often hold up as an ideal. It's just kind of interesting. I'll try to link to that article on the website. But do you have thoughts on the giving aspect being a public endeavor?
Well, I'm not real thrilled with making it a public endeavor simply because then people give in order to impress.
Yeah.
I'm fascinated with the words of Jesus where he doesn't say in the Sermon on the Mount that it's sinful to stand on the street corner, blow your trumpets, and then give your alms. He says it's stupid because what you've received is the reward of man. Rather than the reward of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really would not be a big fan of anything in our church that made public who gave what, because I feel like I'm stealing their rewards. And I ran into that personally as a young youth pastor. I was in a church that raised a significant amount of its money from some high-profile fundraising events, banquets, things like that. You would sponsor a number of tables, and then you'd be listed for the number you did. And here I'm the youth pastor, and I just felt God calling me to give one-tenth of my income off the top as a really young Christian, and was doing that. And I looked, and I realized, you know what? If I could buy as many tables as the wealthiest guy in the church and have my name at the top of that list, when I saw just my little youth pastor tithe. And frankly, it was tempting to say, rather than give towards God, why don't I get this applause of man?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one reason I'm not a big fan of. Again, I don't think it's wrong. Somebody wanted to build a building here and said, put my name on it. I'd go, great, give me the money, I'll put your name on it. But I would see it not as sinful, but it's pretty stupid.
Yeah, it's interesting because as sociologists, and you know, so I'm straddling this line of between a practicing Christian, hearing what you're saying, and also the sociologist who's you know studied the issue of shaming and how this can actually influence people's behavior and such. There's a recent story, I don't know, about a year or two ago, where a Catholic parish out on the East Coast decided to publicize what everybody was giving. And there is huge controversy over this, and that one of the reasons that the parish priest did this was because the donations had been dropping, and he wanted to shame some people into giving. And it did have that effect. But on the other hand, a lot of people were upset because they felt this was really a private matter. And this takes me—oh, go ahead. You got a thought on that?
That's uniquely American, I think, that— It's funny. People will talk about their sexual behavior, their activities. They'll talk about anything, but they won't talk about their income, and they won't talk specifically about their giving. That's just a very private thing in our culture. So, you know, the idea that, well, it's just between me and God, I'm not so sure that has a lot of weight, because that doesn't get somebody off the hook. But again, once you start shaming that way, and or the flip side, building somebody's ego, I think you've started down a slippery slope that might take you, might fund your ministry, but not, might not take your people where you want to take them.
Yeah. Well, that brings me to one of the issues that I had mentioned at the beginning of the podcast in your introduction here, the knowledge about who is giving and who is not. And in Christianity Today, there was this debate over whether or not the lead pastor, or I guess that could include members of the pastoral clergy, as well as assistant pastors, youth pastors, etc., should have knowledge about what members are giving. Now, some people have argued that this should be left to third-party professionals, in the accounting office, or the board of elders or something, since they not only have the financial judgment skills, but if the argument is if the pastor had access to this information, it might taint how he interacts with the individuals of the church. And the related argument here, I guess, is that pastors also have enough to do worrying about the spiritual mission of the church that it's best to leave the financial management job to others. Now, in your blog response to that question, and we'll link to that on our website here, you said that you used to be in the I don't know who gives what camp, but recently you had a change of mind. So take us through your thoughts on this matter, starting with why you didn't want to know who was giving what in your congregation to begin with.
Yeah, well, I was a very proud card-carrying member of the I don't know who gives what. I would tell our people that as if there was some sort of value in that for years. And I just think I had some goofy thinking at that point, both theologically and leadership-wise. Theologically, I'm not sure where I got it except for, you know, the passages that I mentioned where you're not supposed to give in a way that's to be showy and stuff like that. And then leadership-wise, I don't know what I was thinking, because no one leads anything without knowing where the funds come from. And no one in ministry does. There's not a Christian college or seminary where the leadership doesn't know. There's not a missionary that doesn't know who their supporters are. There's not a parachurch organization that doesn't know. But somehow a pastor is supposed to be kept in the dark. And then the irony is, people go, well, it might taint how you treat people. Well, good night. The things I know about people, if they're giving is way down the list compared to other things that in counseling and situations you hear about and you have to deal with. And bottom line, I just came to the conclusion, if I'm so much immature that I can't deal with people appropriately, knowing what they give or don't give, then they probably ought to fire me and get somebody who's spiritually mature enough to deal with that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
A major shift for me at that point.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting to think about. Well, people trust you with lots of other very, you know, personal, private information, and yet
incredibly personal.
Yeah. Yes. And yet, when it comes down to financial things, you mentioned, yeah, this might be a uniquely American thing. They say, oh my gosh, how could you dare know what I'm giving to the church? One of the things about the temptation, though, and I've heard this casually from a number of other people, at some of larger churches where they do have multiple ministers, I have heard complaints by the congregants saying that, well, if you're a big donor and you have other pastoral issues you want to address, you get to go straight to the head of the class. You go get to the lead pastor. But if you're only giving small potatoes, you're shuffled off to the assistant pastors. Is there some kind of temptation to deal with it? I mean, it's the same thing that runs in universities, too. If you plop down $1 million check for the football team, well, you know, by golly, the president of the university is going to talk with you. But if it's a $5 or $10 donation, you have an issue, good luck getting in that door.
Well, there's a couple of things. First of all, I'm sure there are some situations where it's to the point of being evil in the way people are treated based on what they give. Because what I would look for in people's lives is not the amount of money, but the amount of sacrifice. But doggone it, somebody who throws a little $5 tip in the basket each and every week versus somebody who sacrificially gives a large amount, that person who gives a large amount should have the ability to be listened to, just as somebody who's been a Sunday school teacher for 15 years is going to be listened to differently than somebody who showed up last week. Now, access doesn't mean control. So somebody who's been a growth group leader for us for 20 years, they write a little complaint on a worship response card. In light of their investment as a stakeholder in this church, I probably would jot them a little quick answer, give them a phone call. Same with a larger donor. Same with someone who has just volunteered their time working around in a helps ministry or whatever. So it's not a money thing. It's an investment of a stakeholder. But still, having said that, what that means is they should get a chance to be listened to, but they should never turn me into a puppet. I mean, because ultimately it's what the scriptures say and what does God want. And I've had very hard conversations with very committed volunteers and very large donors, and so like, well, hey, if they need to go somewhere else, fine, go somewhere else. But I'm not going to sell this ministry or my soul because of how much money somebody gives or how much volunteer time somebody's given. And the irony of the worry, like, oh, they get in first. These people don't even know how much somebody gives anyway. They're just making assumptions. And that's why I think a leader needs to know, is because we all live in the realm of assumptions. And every single pastor I've ever met who decided, no, I'm going to look, has been blown away with how inaccurate their assumptions were.
Really?
That people have presented themselves as large donors and they don't give anything. They're big hat, no cattle people. And the flip side, there are some people who are just amazing in their sacrificial commitment, even if the dollar number itself is not large.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me of the passage in Mark chapter 12 with the elderly lady who gave the 2 pennies. And everybody had laughed at her, but you know, on the scheme of things, that was a major sacrifice that she was giving.
Yeah. For instance, we do some thank yous for our growth group leaders. Nobody gets bothered about that. And we do some special thank yous for those who go above and beyond. We do it with youth workers. We do it with Sunday school teachers. We do it with people. We have a huge community service ministry here. We do it with the people who go above and beyond there. And we also have some thank yous for people who go above and beyond in their giving. But when we do that, again, it's not just high donors. It's also the people who you look at and you realize, you know what? They are maybe not giving a large amount, but they're giving a large percentage because you know their job.
Yeah.
And they, too, get the same thank you as someone who maybe has a few more zeros in their check.
And I'm sure you're also looking at other indicators of sacrifice as well, because I know, you know, financially,
absolutely,
some folks, you know, young or in their retired age, they don't have the financial resources. So, you know, they're the folks that come and set up chairs or something. So that probably factors in, right?
Totally. Just as I mentioned, all of those groups get a thank you. But what struck me when I changed my mind years ago was, why is money the one thing we treat so differently? That just seems very strange that I thank everybody for everything except for money. That's the one thing I act as if it's just owed me.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. Now, you mentioned on your blog post, too, when you were talking about how you had changed your mind, that you received an email from somebody, and it almost, I don't know if you want to share this email or not, that somebody was actually using their financial contributions as a leverage point to get some changes in the church.
Yes, we were, it's on the stories on my blog, in fact. Eventually the guy decided to come forward and expose who he was, and I said, okay, well, I'm going to answer. And from his viewpoint, you know, it was a horrible thing that I responded as I did by looking at his finances. But to get back to what happened is we were building a new campus, and there is a union in Los Angeles, construction union, one of them, that their tactic when they don't get a job is not to protest at the site, but find some other situation where they think they can be more noticed. So we had nothing to do with which bids were picked, and some of our workers were union and some weren't. They stood in front of our church with a 16-foot long sign every week for months, with a shame on North Coast Church sign. That's what it just said. And ironically, they weren't the union workers holding it. They were people they hired at minimum wage, not in the union to hold it. But they were there during every one of our service and 8 to 5 all day long, right at the entrance, trying to, I don't know, shame us into doing differently. It was a drywall bid, and it was something like $180,000 more expensive. So realizing this is donated money, that we decided we weren't going to go with a high bidder. There was a gentleman, and we have lots of union workers here, but this particular guy was obviously a union worker from his little note, and he wrote me and he said how disturbed he was that we would not use a company that paid, in his mind, living wages, he said, and medical, or I forget the exact words of it. But it was quite obvious that he thought we should hire the higher company. And then he said, until this is resolved, this is the key, until this is resolved, my wife and I are going to withhold our first fruits, which is, you know, code word for tithing. So I decided to look, since he said they're going to do that, well, what does that mean? Not in terms of how to respond, we'd already responded. But like, okay, how do, what do I write this guy? If he's been very generous, I write and say, I appreciate your generosity, but, you know, we have been given this money by donors, some of them who don't make a whole lot of money, and we just can't throw $180,000 away to give it to the highest bidder. But when I went and looked, I found out that his donations were rather minuscule. And so that meant he needed more of an Ananias and Sapphira type response of, well, you're talking like this big donor that's going to withhold stuff, and in reality, you're not giving anything. So he didn't need the same understanding letter. He needed more of a rebuke for his pretending to be more than he was.
It was an interesting post that, and the response that you gave is on the blog post. And my initial reaction was like, wow, if I would have got that from a pastor, I guess I would have been kind of shocked. I guess shocked, one, that you looked up the information. But then as I started thinking about this, and I thought about this over a couple of days, I said, you know, actually, there's some other spiritual issues there, because it sounds like this guy is trying to, you know, manipulate the church with some false information. And, you know, that's something else that needs to be addressed. And in many ways, your response did that, which I thought was rather creative.
Yeah, absolutely. At this point, it was, he needed a rebuke because he was threatening us with, I'm going to withhold my money, and implying that that was a large amount of money. And it's like, okay, I'm going to call your bluff. And then when you find out, you know, again, if he had been our largest donor, he would have got the same response, which is, I'm sorry we made this decision. And if you don't agree with it, that's okay. You know, you can either stay here or go somewhere else. But, you know, we don't respond when people say, I'm going to withhold money. It's like, okay, great. We're listening to God, not your checkbook.
No, it was a great response. And I urge our listeners to go ahead and check that out on your blog post, because it did generate a lot of interesting discussion. And actually, one of the first comments that was in response to that blog post, I actually found to be very interesting. The point that person was making was that, in terms of whether or not a pastor should look at somebody's financial contributions, oftentimes that can be very helpful in giving a pastor the idea that there might be something wrong, that before somebody leaves the church, they often just start withholding financial contributions. So this gives you perhaps the opportunity to go up to them and say, hey, you know, notice your financial contributions are down. Or, are you going through a rough spell? Or, you know, is there something you don't like about the church that we could talk about? And what were your thoughts on that one?
Well, we actually get a thing that lets us know when there's a change, significant change, up or down. We don't go to the people and say, hey, we've noticed it's up or down, but we realize that's an indicator of a life change, and we will find some way to say, how are they doing? If it went down, it could be they lost their job and we need to minister to them, but they haven't even said anything. Or again, once you're 300-400 even, the church can be too large to notice those things. It can mean they're going through a crisis. You know, last on my list is that they're mad at the church. I mean, I hope I don't live in the zone where I'm constantly trying to keep everybody happy, because even Jesus couldn't pull that one off. So I'm just trying to be faithful. But at the same time, yes, that's a very early indicator that something has changed in their life. And if it's not for the good, if we can know that and be helpful, that's a good thing. Whether or not that ever brings some money back, it's like, well, who cares on that? That's totally secondary to ministering to the people.
Yeah, I'm sure that goes in many ways to your ideas about the sticky church as well, too. That's just everybody watching over everybody else in a very caring or pastoral manner. So that kind of gives some indication of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. One of the questions that we just mentioned earlier.
By the way, let me step back and say one thing. It's the same thing when we have a long-term volunteer who takes some time off.
Yeah,
it's not just money. The problem comes, we focus on money as if it's all by itself. And we do one of two things. We focus money all by itself, or we take money out of the equation. And money is just one more thing. Their volunteer time. We notice when people's attendance shifts, that's also an indicator something's going on in their life. So I don't want to keep money out of the equation, but I don't want to make it the only thing in the equation either. It's just throw it in. It's one more important variable.
Let me ask about that. You mentioned if somebody's attendance shifts, and you're a pretty big church, 8,000 folks every Sunday and across three different campuses. How do you notice attendance shifts? So it's not like somebody's checking in at the door, roll call for, you know, class or something.
You'd be surprised. It's one of the little speeches I give when at conferences. I'm a booger about. I want to know accurate numbers. So, like, our attendance numbers are accurate. We take those worship response cards, which I only get about 60% compliance of people filling it out, but that's still better than zero, and we record those. We also, another source is, of course, we know donors even without the name. That shows a connection. And then a third, most important, is in our small groups, which we have such a high percentage of people in. We keep accurate attendance every single week. Mm-hmm. And we chase that down. I ask people, I go, how many of you count the money? Everybody raises their hand. And I say, well, do you just look at it and say, ah, that looks like $1,000? You count it to the penny. They all go, oh, I count it to the penny. I say, how many of you send out IRS notices? Oh, they all raise their hand. I go, do you send the money to a donor and say, we think you gave about $2,000 last year? And they all laugh. And it's like, oh, no, to the penny. So I say this. I say, then you've just told me money is more important than people.
Uh-huh.
That if we can find a way to count to the penny where it came from and thank people, how in the world can we say it's too hard to find out who was at a Bible study, a Sunday school class, or whatever? It's just a matter of time and effort. So we work really hard at that.
That's a really great point. And I have to thank you on behalf of the sociological profession, because we love churches that are counting and take good data. So who knows, someday somebody will be knocking on your door saying, oh, we're doing a study on attendance. And
yeah. Well, you can't, again, I said it earlier in this interview, you can't count numbers. You have to count faces.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you just told the story of the one who went away and then leaving the 99 behind. If you're not counting faces, you're only counting numbers, you don't even know what's going on in the lives of people. It's the great temptation of growth.
Yeah. And again, it's also the great temptation of sociology, too, because we like those numbers. And we just had this great discussion about how it's not just money, but other things. And so now I'm going to bring it all back again to money, because that's, again, that's one of the things I'm fascinated with and I want to focus on a bit here. But how do you deal with a situation like we've been in the last 2 or 3 years where the economy has really been sour and contributions have dropped? And I know our own church has gone through some very rough times, and we've had a very significant financial deadline to meet for our church. And it, you know, it was really difficult. I could see this in the face of the pastor to really go out and ask. It's almost an awkward thing for a pastor to say, listen, we're in a financial bind. Can you give us some money here? Because a lot of times the folks that go into the ministry, or when you go through divinity school or your theological training, they never teach you how to do that kind of stuff. So how do you deal with that situation when contributions are down? You do need to get the contributions up. Is it an awkward moment? What do you do?
Well, we just tell people the truth. And we have some pretty good credibility here because we don't cry wolf. And we don't do a lot of fundraising at all. In fact, I don't have a problem with churches do. We don't even have a stewardship month once a year or whatever. I will talk unashamedly about money and very directly about it when it's in a text. But we don't have a series of fundraising messages every year to, quote, help with our budget. So when we ran into some difficulty with this economy, which we did, we just sent out a letter telling people, here's the facts. We took a 3% across the board payroll cut, and we cut back this last year on retirement accounts for people, which meant our leaders had the biggest bite taken out.
Mm-hmm.
And we told people that, and we promised them we're going to live within our means just like we expect you to. And the response to that was incredible. They were very thankful to have a place that didn't beat around the bush and told the truth. We didn't hit them with a drive-by guilting that you need to give more. We felt people were generous, but we knew some people, once they knew the facts, might step up to the plate differently. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't a begging feel, which I think always goes backwards. People don't want to give to a sinking ship.
Yeah.
And it certainly wasn't a drive-by guilting. It's just, hey, here's the facts. You deserve to know these.
That's a interesting point in dealing with this. Hey, here's another thought, too, because when it comes to those message appeals, a lot of people think of the televangelists and that being that they've been on the television since the advent of cable in every household really can, I think, in many ways taint the image of Christianity and make it more difficult for some places that need money, saying, well, you know, you're just asking for money because this is just a big money-making scheme or something. Have you faced any kind of blowback on that?
Oh, a little bit, but I think more often than not, it's an excuse. Somebody, they will push back in that area because it makes it easy for them to say, I'm not going to give anything. Ironically, it's your most generous donors who line up and say you should talk about money more. It's the people who don't give anything who say, you're always talking about money, which is really weird when I hear that around here because we never do. But, boy, you just make a little peep and somebody's feeling pretty guilty and they'll go after it.
Yeah.
So I obviously there's some weird excesses out there, but I think, especially if you've been around a ministry a long time or it's small enough, they know the leadership, they know your heart.
Yeah. I mean, this is just a tangent question to related to all this, and I brought up the issue of televangelists and such. And recently, there's been a trend or phenomena going around various evangelical churches about this prosperity gospel and the issue of money and giving as a way to bring you back wealth that becomes a big theme for some of these churches. What's your thought on that whole prosperity gospel trend?
Well, that's where I've been in ministry long enough to see that it's always there and it goes around in circles. You get some 35 to 45-year-old person preaching that, and everybody wants to believe that there's a get-rich-quick scheme, whether it's penny stocks or it's, hey, give more to God, whatever it would be. And then they get 50, 60 years old, and they start building hospitals. So it's kind of a cycle you can see over and over again. But I think all you've got to do is look at Scripture, and you'd find the prosperity gospel is pretty hollow. I mean, the best of the best, according to God, in the beginning of the book of Job was Job, and he was hardly a guy who experienced prosperity as a result of that. I think of a Daniel. I think of a Joseph most of his life. And I think of the New Testament exhortations on how to deal with money. He says, teach the rich not to be arrogant, not to trust in it, and be generous. He doesn't say, teach them to be more godly so they can get richer. At the same time, there's always not only a prosperity gospel, there's a counter movement, which is basically, I call them the money police. And they are the people who think that it's our job to always take care of every need anywhere around the world, and anything you have nice, you shouldn't have. And both of them, I say, you know, get off it. And why don't you just teach us to listen to the Scriptures and the Spirit, and we'll live as He tells us instead of how you tell me.
Well, in the remaining time that we have here, we have a few more minutes. I want to come back to your book on the sticky church. And I found that fascinating. I haven't had a chance to peruse it. I've looked at it a little bit online.
It'll change your life. No.
Okay, well, you know, there you go. And you also had a complimentary book on that called Sticky Teams. And I was wondering if, you know, you could, again, we asked you to talk a little bit about that beginning, but if you could go in a little bit more depth and if you had the possibility to give some advice to other churches that are out there from your own experiences with this idea of the sticky church or the sticky teams, you know, what could you give? We do have a number of pastors and ministers that do listen to us, and I think they'd love to hear it.
Well, sticky church is actually, in a sense, two books in one, because you can be a sticky church without using our model. The paradigm of sticky church is focusing on relationships and focusing on shutting the back door before you spend all your attention on the front door. So it's a plea to think through things. For instance, so many of our churches spend so much time providing the community holiday entertainment, always with the idea that if we open this door larger and larger on these special holidays, people will come the rest of the year, and they flat out don't.
Yeah.
So there's a paradigm that's a challenge in the sticky church. And then the last half of the book explains our lecture lab model of what we call those sermon-based small groups, where we take the text and the topic of the weekend sermon and dig deeper into it. So you don't have to do that. That's one methodology that is very organic and very simple to create these relationships, because most anybody can do a discussion of what they heard on the previous weekend, as opposed to the typical Bible studies that take much more teaching and inductive skills.
Well, what do you mean by that term, lecture lab? That was a little bit of a
buzzword. Well, we talk about a subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes we do topical sermons. We go through books. Right now we're in a study of the book of Luke that's, oh my goodness, I think this week will be the 42nd or 43rd message on it, and we're only in chapter 18. So we'll do different kinds of things, but What I will speak on this weekend, all of our small groups then will dig deeper into the next weekend. They'll look at parallel passages that talk about the same subject. They'll do some history giving in their own life based on the principles that were given there. And then, of course, there's some application. So it's I call it Youth Ministry 101. Every youth pastor knows you don't just teach the kids. You get them to talk about it first, or you teach them and get them to talk about it later. That's all we're doing. In fact, North Coast is a youth group for adults, what I tell people sometimes. And then sticky teams is just how do you build healthy teams so it that can stick together through thick and thin. That's basically what that book's about.
And have since implementing these changes, have you seen a noticeable increase of people who are not leaving out the back door or doing the revolving door thing?
We did the sticky church paradigm back at 180, and we've grown to over 8,000 without any marketing or special programs ever. So obviously it's worked quite well over the long haul. What has been fascinating to me is the book has sold quite well, and to see across the country and even overseas, people picking up that paradigm, because frankly, a lot of small groups have morphed today into being a way to administrate the church or grow the church, not to take care of the people. So this call back to being truly shepherds and putting the people we have as more important than the people we want to reach, with the idea we'll reach them when we take care of who we have, has resonated with pastors around the country of both small and extremely large churches. I had a guy fly out from the Philippines to talk to me a couple weeks ago that has oversees a church of 50,000 multiple campuses. Same thing, is like, wow, that is just, that's what we needed to hear. So that's the big change I've seen, more than in our own church because we've done it so long.
You just mentioned something interesting that you shouldn't be using small groups to manage your church. What do you mean by that? I guess it's pretty hard for me to differentiate between caring for people and managing the church. For me, there seems to be
overlap. Managing shows up in these things. When it's, we tell people, well, these groups are designed to grow, divide, multiply, grow, divide, multiply. People don't want to do that. In a highly mobile culture that most of us live in, you finally connected some real and genuine friends, and we say, now if you love Jesus, say goodbye to them all. And I look at that and I go, that's crazy.
Yeah.
I have a chapter in the book called Why Dividing Groups is a Dumb Idea. But the standard small group mantra out there is, oh, no, you grow stale after a year or two, so divide them. And well, that's about growing the church. Or you put them in neighborhoods. That's about administering the church. And people don't live in neighborhoods anymore. You know, they get in a car and drive out of it. The new neighborhoods are your workplace, your special interests, your station in life. They'll have an empty chair in them and say, you're supposed to lead somebody to Jesus and fill that chair. And all of those things are ways to administrate and manage the church. And it's a top-down view rather than a bottom-up view of these small groups.
I can see that's rather interesting, and I'm going to refer our listeners to those books. You can check them out on our website, Sticky Church and Sticky Teams, as well as a number of other books you've written and your blog. I think we've had a great discussion here. I've learned a lot about this stuff, and I want to thank you, Larry, for being on Research on Religion.
Great. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.